Where warp meets weft. Where warp meets weft. This is Weavecast with Sine Mitchell.
Welcome to episode 24, Tapestry. Tapestry is an art form that is, at its core, very simple. You are weaving plain weave, but which can also become very complicated in terms of number of wefts and direction of wefts and all the different layerings of color that are possible. We talk today to Sarah Sweat, who helps us wrap our mind around this simple yet complex art form, and she shares with us many of her secrets of success. And in the final essay, I talk a little bit about my attempts to learn tapestry. The last few weeks have been incredibly busy. I'm working on a new project that launches in February, and which I'll be talking about more on the next show. I can't wait for that to be done so I can share it with you. I have a correction. Last episode, I asked Della Cheney about warp-weighted looms for Ravenstail and Chilcat weaving. Now, this question was based on a loom I had seen in a museum in Haines, where there were little bags hanging from the warp, and I assumed that those were weights. Well, Anna Zinsmeister was kind enough to email me and tell me that Ravenstail and Chilcat are woven without tension. The weaver holds small groups of warp while twining the weft around. And so those bags aren't weights. They're just there to hold the extra warp and protect it during that twining process. So thank you for the correction, Anna. Another thing I'd like to mention, if you are the kind of person who downloads the MP3s and never goes up to the website, you might want to stop by. We've had some interesting discussions and clarifications going on in the comments. I've had a report that on some configurations, iTunes is not recognizing when I post a new episode. I'm not sure what's going on here because it works in my iTunes. It's hard to test for because it's one of those raise your hands, everyone who's not here situations. A way around this is even if you are subscribing in iTunes, it might be worth your while to go ahead and go up to the subscriptions page on the site and sign up for an email subscription. And what this will do is when I post a new episode, you will get an email that will ensure that if iTunes lets you down, you will know about new episodes. I keep those email addresses in complete confidence. I share them with no one. And if you have questions about the Weavecast privacy policy, there's a link to it in the footer on the Weavecast site. There's an online video of an interview of tapestry artist Barbara Heller. She does some really powerful work. The video is about 10 minutes. I will have a link to that in the show notes. Other resources, if you're trying to learn tapestry, there are a couple of wonderful books put out by Nancy Harvey, as well as a newer book by Kirsten Glassbrook called Tapestry Weaving, which has a sampler that I've been working through. And there's also a book by our guest today called Kids Weaving. This is an incomplete list, and I, right now, am trying to learn tapestry. So if you have any other recommendations of really good tapestry books, I would love it if you would put a comment in the show notes so I can check those out. Our sponsor this episode is Just Our Yarns. If you've been listening to Weavecast for a while, you'll notice that they are a longtime supporter of the show, and we really appreciate all of their encouragement and help. They will be at the Madrona Fiber Arts Winter Retreat in February. That's in Tacoma. So if you appreciate their help putting out the show, please stop by their booth and say thank you. I'll be at the retreat as well. I'll be teaching on Friday and Sunday. And all day Saturday, I will be in the atrium demonstrating weaving. So if you're at the retreat, come by and say hi to me too. I'd love to see you. If you won't be in Tacoma this year, you can check out Just Our Yarn up on the web at www.justouryarn.com. When you go to the website, you'll find their selection of gorgeous hand-painted yarns, in luxury fibers, and they do lovely work, good, solid, strong yarns, and I just love their colorways. We are going to go to our guest today. Her name is Sarah Sweat. She is a fabulous tapestry artist who does amazing work. I'll have a link to her gallery on the show notes. She does really interesting things with color. That's all I'm going to say. Just go look at the pictures. She was recently a guest at the Seattle Weavers Guild and had time after that in order to meet with me. So without further ado, Sarah Sweat. I really enjoyed your talk yesterday at the Seattle Weavers Guild.
Oh, thanks.
Your work. The tapestries are just gorgeous. They're very painterly, not photorealistic, but yet, you know, you've got that artistic sensibility. The borders are almost as lovely as the rest of the tapestry itself. I mean, you've obviously put a lot of thought and planning into them. They're all your original art. So I am just delighted to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here. It's quite a treat.
How did you get started weaving? I'm always curious.
Somewhat accidentally. I was a knitter from the time I was tiny. Don't even remember learning how to knit, except that one grandmother taught me and the other grandmother criticized how the one grandmother taught me. And she said, no, Sarah, you're not knitting. That's purling. And I just loved making things, always loved making things with whatever was at hand, mostly fabric, though. I remember begging my mother to teach me to sew and knitting my first sweater when I was in Ireland traveling with a grandmother when I was 14. We picked needles and yarn and went. This is not a knitting podcast, I know, but
we talk knitting here. I've got knitting over there on the counter.
Well, we were traveling around Ireland, and I really, once I got started, we picked this thing with cables, and it was my first sweater, and I'd never done any cables, but I just fell in love with it, and it made absolute sense to me, and I spent the entire time not looking at Ireland, but down looking at my cables and how to turn them, and a week after I got home, I lost the pattern.
Oh, no.
And I thought, oh, well, that's the end. And then I started looking at it and realized that I could probably figure out what was going on and how to do that. And I found another pattern that was kind of the same and looked at it, which was a wonderful thing in many ways because it allowed me to realize that shape is shape and that I actually probably know more than I think I know. And I think that stood me in good stead later. I didn't learn to weave until 1987 or 8 when I was at the University of Idaho. And I finally was in one place. I'd been living in a lot of different places, some of them quite remote, and didn't have access to anything except knitting needles. And I made myself a hand spindle and spun for a couple of years on that and saw no reason why I should buy a wheel until I tried one and realized it was just a little bit faster. And knit all the time, but was going to the university to find some profession other than knitting, which wasn't lucrative, and caretaking ranches in the wilderness, of which there were not very many jobs. I went back and was going to become, among a number of things, eventually a science teacher, and was studying chemistry and physics and biology. But two things happened at once. I met a guy that I was going to marry, and I walked into the weaving lab upstairs at the University of Idaho. They had the most incredible room you ever saw. It was huge, giant, north-facing windows, wall-to-wall looms, most of them Gilmore's, but some big old Swedish looms and some counterbalances. Shirley Metzger, who was then on the faculty at the University of Idaho, was in charge of this magnificent room. I think it was the entire top floor, practically, of the Department of Home Economics. I walked in, and she showed us what a shuttle was, and she showed us what a warp was, and said, now go buy this stuff and come back tomorrow. And I did, and I don't think I've looked back since. I dropped calculus the next day. I've done nothing but weave and knit and make things since.
You started weaving on floor looms.
Yep.
How did you come to specialize in tapestry?
Shirley Metzger, my teacher, was part of the Palouse Hills Weavers Guild, and she, with the guild, were putting on a workshop. And as often happens with workshops, it wasn't quite filling. She came to me and said, Sarah, you should take this tapestry workshop. And I said, no, I'm only interested in making dish towels and baby blankets. Because in fact, I was. I loved multi-harness weaving. I loved complex twills. I was just learning what they all were, making drawdowns. And I had a science background, and it was a real treat to turn that piece of my brain into these warp and weft structures. And I didn't think that tapestry was going to suit me. So I said, no, Shirley, I don't think I will. And she said, well, Sarah, how about if I give you extra credit? I, being easily bribed, said, sure. I decided to take this workshop, and it turned out that it suited me down to the ground. I understood absolutely what the teacher, Joanne Hall, was getting at. The shapes made sense. And I've always loved to draw. The drawing has always been there, and didn't realize that drawing and weaving could go hand in hand. Tapestry, there it was. Although I didn't do any for another 4 months until my son started napping for 2 hour stretches. And as soon as he started napping for 2 hour stretches, I thought, I'll just put on one little warp. And I'll do this one idea, and if I hate it, then I'll just use the rest of the warp for rugs, because I had a huge glamacra, a 64-inch glamacra, 8-harness, ready for all my complex twills and things. And after that first one, I don't think I ever did anything other than plain weave.
I'm surprised that you don't have a background in drawing or painting. You are self-taught in that, or have
I'm
you?
I'm pretty much self-taught. I did at the University of Idaho take 2 semesters of basic drawing, but I had already been drawing for a long time, so I didn't have a lot of formal structure, but I'd learned a lot of things on my own and didn't see why I couldn't. The drawing, particularly, I worked through Betty Edwards' wonderful book, Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain, which is a favorite for many, many people, and it helped me to see things, to look at shapes and see them as the shapes they are and think about negative space. I'd never heard the term negative space before talking to her. And that was really extremely applicable to tapestry, because in tapestry, there is really no negative space. When Betty Edwards in particular talks about drawing the space around objects, all those are spaces that as a tapestry weaver, I get to weave. I don't leave them on the paper. I'm actually making those shapes. And so I think about that a lot when I'm designing.
I think what keeps a lot of people away from tapestry weaving is they don't feel they have the qualifications to draw unique artwork.
I think it's something that does stop people. It's too bad, because so much of tapestry, A, is not even pictorial. I mean, so much of it is just the beauty of shapes and getting blocks of color next to each other. And I think that's one of the things that I loved about it first, because as a knitter, I love to knit and I love to knit with color patterns, but I loathe intarsia. And I've tried it and I've done all sorts of other knitting, but I can't do it. It just irritates me. But essentially, tapestry is intarsia weaving. It's small blocks of color next to each other, except that you can build up one area of color at a time and you can focus on that one color and you don't have to do all these little joins. Now, there would be tapestry weavers who would disagree with me because they weave selvage to selvage and they're making joins all the way across. But I weave in such a way that I leave slits around the shapes and build up one area of color at a time. So it's possible just to go that direction and think about color and think about shapes next to other shapes. As for the narrative storytelling picture part, we are so blessed in this century with these amazing things like digital cameras where you can take a photograph. I love to pull elements out of those photographs. And I think a lot of people forget that they can do that, that they can either trace or draw through using a piece of graphite paper to get a shape that they're, in a sense, afraid to draw. And it's nice because you don't have to go and shoot a whole roll of film and get it developed. You can actually just print out a picture and then simplify it. And then, of course, there are amazing tapestry weavers who design on the computer using Photoshop and all those. Now, I'm not good at that part. I am a pencil and paper gal. I love getting out the piece of paper. I love big, soft number 9B pencils that make great black marks. And then I make a mistake and then have to use up half an eraser to erase it. But I find them very, very satisfying to make those lines. And what I find is with a pencil is you can build shapes until it looks the way you want it to be. If you're not working from something specific like a photograph, you can just start drawing a tree, for instance, and then just keep adding to it until it takes on a pleasing shape. And a lot of that has to do with noticing what you like, noticing what shapes please you. And I think that's one of the most essential thing as any kind of a creative person, is not getting caught up in what colors look good, what shapes look good, what does a tree really look like, but what shape of a tree makes me feel good.
Now, you've talked about building up blocks of color in your tapestries, but you also do a lot of subtle shadings. I've seen in some of your tapestries, you'll have, for example, a glass, and you can see not only the glass, but the things kind of behind it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love transparency.
How do you get that beautiful shading?
Lots and lots of little bits of yarn. The shading itself comes from the cartoon making. when I'm drawing on a large piece of paper with a pencil, only in black and white. Everything is either black or white or a shade of gray. It's a value. So later on when I'm weaving, I look at the colors in terms of their value, and so that they have to, in a sense, match what's on the cartoon. But when I'm actually physically weaving, I love to use small, tiny smidgens of yarn and think about, okay, what color is behind the glass and what color is the glass? And blending yarn so that, for instance, for some things, I'll use one strand of glass color and one strand of what's on the other side. Or the same with water, so that you get things that are overlapping. It's one of the small things that amuse me particularly about tapestry, is making this very woolly, fluffy medium depict things like glass and water that normally you would think, well, that's glass is not desperately fluffy. But in fact, that it can be rendered and you can get this sense of transparency and depth. Non-objective tapestries, non-pictorial ones, they're some of my favorites. The work of Michael Rohde or James Kohler or Mary Zickafoos, who do these fabulous, incredible things with color and movement, but without image. I find I adore looking at that, but when it comes to actually weaving my own work or weaving my own ideas and stories, it's the things around me that intrigue me, as well as this sense of getting sucked into a space that maybe didn't exist before and creating a space, a place that didn't exist before, like writing fiction. You've created a world and the viewer gets drawn in and then maybe makes up their own story and imagines themselves in it.
A lot of your tapestries seem to be telling a story, and you'll have a series that reference the same characters.
Mm-hmm. I think that maybe is just a general artist thing, is that you work in series. As I weave, I listen to a lot of books on tape, and I'm listening right now to Anthony Trollope, the Barchester series, and he has the Warden and the Barchester Towers, and they go on, and they're all vaguely about this one town, and characters appear and reappear. And I think that's kind of how my work actually is. All my work, in a sense, is both about imaginary places that I think about, as well as my world living on the Palouse, that this particular area of north central Idaho, which is very hilly and round. It's a beautiful place and it's filled with wonderful people, and many of them have agreed to be my models. So I use the same models over and over. And often I use myself, in large part because the stories are mine and I don't mind making myself look funny. And also because I'm there and I'm cheap. And I don't object to trying things out. Again, with that digital camera, I'll often take pictures of myself. And I'll go back and forth between being the model and the artist and set up the camera and set it on timer and then run over and be whoever it is I'm wanting to be. And then I'll go back and look at the picture and think, no, you didn't do that right at all. Next time, bend your knee. And then I'll click the thing again and run over and bend my knee. Try to behave. I'm making up these stories and then making up the scenarios for them and then drawing the landscapes. And I pretty much entirely make up the landscapes. I don't like or need photo reference for landscape. I just like to see what happens.
You said something else interesting in your talk. One of the things that's kept me away from tapestry is the backside. In some tapestry traditions, if you look at the backside, there are all these strings hanging out. And for me, that feels like putting on beautiful clothes and then having on dirty underwear. So... So I'm wondering, what brought you to make your tapestries double-sided? Why weave that way? And how is it done?
I certainly didn't learn that way. I learned with dropping the ends to the back. The first tapestry I did that was two-sided was an experiment. It was actually also my first natural dye tapestry. And so I felt free to just try this entirely new thing. I had read about the way the Navajo untwist and separate their singles yarn. A lot of weavers work with commercial yarns that are plied. So therefore, if you untwist it, you only end up with two separate plies. Whereas if you work with singles, as the Navajo do, you can untwist that single ply and pull apart the yarn so that you end up with a wispy end. And then they weave that wispy end in. And I had read about them doing that and thought, well, what a fabulous thing to do. But I did not think it would really work with a linen or cotton warp, which is what I had used so far. And what, from my reading, what most tapestry weavers were doing. Because after that first workshop, I wove on my own for 5 years or 6 years. So I really didn't have, other than books, anyone telling me what to do. But I love the idea of using wool warp. I just didn't know if it would work because everybody says you should use linen or cotton. But as a hand spinner, I fully trusted wool warp. And also I had this experience on the very last non-double-sided synthetic dye and linen warp tapestry that I wove, which is called Carolyn and Shithead, which I don't know if you can say it on the air.
Oh, that's the beauty of podcasts. We have no FCC.
Well, Carolyn and Shithead. The Shithead was the name of the dog, as a matter of fact. Her real name was Raggedy Ann, but that's another story. Anyway, I wove this large tapestry, and I was working on the ends, and I happened to tug on one of the linen warp ends, and the whole thing shifted. This is a 6-foot tapestry. And someone might say, well, that was because you didn't pack it tight enough or whatever. But even the possibility that the warp and the weft were not intrinsic to one another made me really nervous. It felt like I was hanging these pieces of yarn on this other structure to which it was not really related. Whereas wool, I knew that a wool warp and a wool weft, as a spinner and just as a textile person in general, I knew that those little tiny fuzzy ends, all those wonderful fibers were going to twine together and probably, if not felt, the little scales on them would join and it would hold it all firmly. That first one that I did where I wove in the ends, I used a singles yarn so I could untwist it and you have a little tapered piece of yarn so that I could weave the entire length out to the very finest, littlest taper at the end, and all those little tiny threads that are on the tapered yarn would then interlock with all the tiny, tiny fibers sticking up from the wool warp, and I would end up with something that was going to lock together and really stick. So it felt safe, which is the short answer. It felt safe to do that and so that they would all hold together. And then, of course, when I'm done, this was another thing that I didn't know tapestry weavers didn't do. What I did was cut the piece off the loom, finish the edges I do a twined edge, which is in Peter Collingwood's book, actually. It's a really nice finish. And then I'd throw it in the bathtub and swish it around a little in the bathtub and then everything. I wouldn't full it exactly, but give it a little chance, everything to relax, and then put it in the washing machine and spin out the water and lay it flat to dry and then press it. Although I've since discovered that if you lay a tapestry flat, put all your art books on top of it. It does all the pressing for you. And then you take off all the art books and the thing's flat, which is very
handy. That's a great tip.
It saves hours of ironing. I brought a tapestry to a show after weaving on my own and doing this, and someone said, it's soft. And I said, well, yeah, but that's not how tapestries feel. Because if you don't wash them, they don't ever have that chance to relax and they end up quite stiff. And I didn't know whether that was the way tapestry was supposed to be, a sort of stiff thing that kind of mirrored painting, but not really. Or what I later decided, and this may not be true at all, is that if people don't do their own dyeing, they don't know that the dye is fast. So there's every possibility of the colors
bleeding
one into the other. And if you don't know, if you haven't tested them, if you're not positive, it's not worth the risk. And so an entire institution, like the grandmother and the turkey wings with the too small thing, people who dyed their own tapestries, you would think that they would want to wash them and have this very fluid feeling because we are making a piece of fabric. I really do notice the difference in an unwashed and a washed tapestry. Certainly my own work is very different. It's much more cardboardy. It feels almost like it's made out of tin before it's washed, and afterward it flows. Not that it doesn't hang fairly straight, but if you walk by it, it can move gently and sort of sway. And I noticed that a lot of tapestries that are not washed, that are merely pressed, don't do that. And I don't know whether people actually prefer it or if it's just something that they've come to prefer because they don't wash them.
Do you think that when the fibers relax, that's part of the reason why your curves flow so fluidly?
I think the curves flow fluidly because I've learned how to make curves.
Because you work very hard with little bits of string.
I spent a lot of hours staring at those warps and thinking about and counting. And in fact, there's a lot of science in the making of curves. And I like to think of it as calculus, but that's because I quit calculus to weave. So I'm still doing calculus.
It is absolutely calculus.
Because it's approaching zero. And how quickly do you approach? And the rate that you're doing, the rate of change. And how you work that rate of change, you go around a certain warp one time and then the next one twice and the next one three times and then four. And the way you choose to make that curve completely defines the way that curve is. And then there's the whole science of hollows and fulls or ups and downs. Most of it is counting and looking and really thinking about what's happening on the warp and not what's happening on the cartoon. You may be a slave to that cartoon, but if you look at the cartoon from slightly above or slightly below, the curve can shift. But if you're looking at what's happening on your warp, then you'll make that curve nice and smooth.
And I do think it's ironic that you are actually spending your entire life now doing calculus.
It is, since I dropped it.
Somewhere out there, there's a calculus teacher going, yes, yes. What surprises you most about tapestry weaving?
How interesting it is. How intriguing. How each time I am surprised and delighted by what happens at the loom and the way the wool reacts and the way that I react to the colors. The lifelong study is watching your own reactions to things and noticing what you like and notice, oh, look at that. And I can be just as thrilled by a lovely curve or by two colors next to each other. The thing I think that surprises me most, particularly as I went away from tapestry for about a year and a half and then just recently came back, is that the pace of it affects my entire life. And I think that as a tapestry weaver, you have to be sitting there in front of the loom weaving tapestry or nothing will happen. But if you are there, fantastic things can happen. But what it means is there are a lot of things you don't do. I don't travel very much. I have some wonderful friends that I see regularly, but I don't go out to dinner a lot. I don't do things during the day if I can possibly help it, because the world ends up becoming the warp. Otherwise nothing happens.
Tapestry is a very slow art form.
It is, in that if you're looking at quantity, it is slow, but things happen continually. And I like to think that the rest of the world is perhaps just a little too fast. In fact, in this year and a half, I've spent a bunch of time painting, and I was painting using egg tempera. And I will probably continue to do some egg tempera paintings. I love it as a medium. It's wonderful. It is, when I started weaving, all the egg tempera painters said, oh, it's very slow. It's very painstaking. And I just laughed because I could, in fact, do a painting in a week. And the idea of doing a complete tapestry in a week is absurd. And I find, actually, after a year or so of painting, that the painting's a little fast. The pace of tapestry allows me to really think about something before I embark on it. It feels like a lesson in trust about what might happen in that period of time. It feels like just part of life, not a thing I'm setting aside. Oh, this is going to take a long time, so therefore that's not good. It's more, oh, this is going to take all summer, so I don't have to think again until sometime next fall about what else I'm going to do. And now I can just immerse myself in this. And there's something so pleasurable about that.
What themes inspire your work? Do you begin with a color, an image? How do you get a project started?
All of the above. Generally, it is an image or a piece of a story. Because in the last couple of years, I've also been writing fiction, I have this sort of imaginary world that I've come up with. So sometimes if real characters aren't leaping out and saying things that make me want to weave them or tell their story, then my imaginary characters do. And I try to visualize them. Sometimes they just show up. There they are, suddenly looking at me and saying, this is how I look and this is how I am and don't you love this posture? And then I will either try to reproduce what I have in my head with a pencil or sometimes using myself as a model in the digital camera, or I'll have a particular friend over and she will pose for me and I'll draw her and take some pictures for reference and use some combination of the two. And then the story, the rest of it evolves from that. And often I have a tendency to want to tell everything there ever was in every tapestry. And it took me years to learn to focus. If you look at my website, some of the earlier work is just really, really busy. There's a lot of stuff going on. There's many, many people and many, many events. And they're very exciting. But I think it was sort of out of a fear that, oh, I only get to make three tapestries this year, so I have to put everything in it. And what I've learned is that I personally prefer a much simpler thing. So I spend a lot of time erasing, putting things in, and then taking them out. No, that doesn't need to be there. Which I suppose, as a writer, I've also learned I spend a lot of time deleting. But getting it down to that nugget only as a black and white cartoon. So I'm just trying to get the essence. Now, it occurs to me now that my father is a fabulous black and white photographer, and I grew up in a house filled with black and white photographs. I'm not a photographer. I'm not a good photographer. One of the reasons I couldn't use his photographs is they're beautiful as photographs. They don't need to be tapestries. But I think it gives me a sense of how things look in black and white, and that the essence of a story is in that black and white way. So then when it comes to color, it's just this added, really fun thing that happens later. And the colors I pick as I'm weaving. So I surround my loom with either one color that I'm totally enamored with where I'm going to start, and then I start adding to that, or else I start out with a whole ton of colors and then subtract. So it kind of depends on my mood.
I'm interested in the period you took a break from tapestry weaving. In my own life, I've had many different art forms, and I found that they influence each other. What caused you to step away from tapestry, and what did you learn during that break period?
What caused me to step away was that I suddenly couldn't weave. Not physically, I just began to dread going to the loom. And I had never had that experience. I started weaving tapestry when my son was an infant, and I had those 2-hour periods when he napped, and I would go straight to the loom and weave for 2 hours until he woke up. And then anything else, dishes, laundry, mowing, took place with him in a backpack or however else. And I continued with that kind of very focused approach with such passion that the moment he was out of the house, or the moment I had a chunk of time, I was in front of the loom, and it was always an unbelievable treat. And for some reason, this one particular tapestry, I just couldn't sit still and do it. What I ended up being drawn to doing instead was other drawings, just a whole lot of drawing rather than working on the one tapestry. And I ended up going off to paint, as I said, and a lot of black and white drawings and a lot more knitting and writing fiction. And I think what it was that I suddenly was overwhelmed by stories. And I was also overwhelmed, or perhaps it finally came home to me, this very irritating thing that the art and textile community has, which is the art-craft debate. As a pictorial tapestry weaver, whose work is often called very painterly, I think I thought, well, so why not just paint? And people often ask me, why not just paint? Well, I didn't know how to paint. I think I felt a certain less-than-ness, as though if I could, I should paint. Because what was the point of really weaving? So in a sense, I think that's part of what pushed me toward trying painting. And I realized that I'm not a great painter. A year and a half does not make you a great painter. But I realized that I could do a lot of painting. I already knew a lot about design and composition and color. And so that it was possible for me to be a painter. And what I realized is there's no mystery about painting. There's no mystery about writing fiction. It's just a matter of sitting down and doing it and practicing and having an idea. That part, of course, for any of them. But in fact, the ideas for all of them are the same. And that's what I learned the most from going off and spending some time painting and spending some time writing fiction and spending a lot of time knitting and even doing some needlepoint. What I found in the end, I wrote about a character in my novel who was weaving tapestries. And she was weaving these long, narrow tapestries, nothing like I had ever woven. As she talked, as it were, or I wrote down what she thought about weaving these things, I was insanely jealous. And I wanted to do it too. And I suddenly thought, but I can. Here's something I know how to do. So I closed the computer and went down to my studio and for the first time in a year and a half, put together one of my pipe looms and warped it up, grabbed some yarn and started to weave and just felt at home. What a relief to be opening these sheds and putting these colors next to each other and doing this thing that I know how to do that I absolutely adore. I haven't looked back other than to notice that they're all the same. It's a continuum, art, craft, who does what, what's better, what's more worthy of this, that, or the other. As far as I'm concerned, no matter what I'm doing, whether it's a drawing or designing a needlepoint or knitting or thinking about sweaters, whatever it is, my feeling, the emotional quality I'm looking for out of that project is the same. And it's just a matter of making it happen and tailoring it to the medium.
Yeah, I think I heard you say yesterday, your art is your art, no matter what the medium is.
Yeah, which I don't think I knew before this year and a half. And I think I needed to know that to go forward as a tapestry weaver, because it is, as Archie Brennan said, an indulgent, elitist, economically farcical, and frequently boring 20th century activity.
Well, on that note, do you have any advice for beginning tapestry weavers?
Weave and weave and make shapes. Just start making shapes. In fact, unless you have a shape that you're longing to make, a certain image, start making little squares. Put colors next to each other. Practice keeping your selvages even and making the slits nice. And just see how great those colors look next to each other. And once you've made a bunch of squares, start practicing curves. Don't make a circle, for goodness sake. Don't start with a circle. There's nothing that's more depressing than a circle. But you can make all sorts of wonderful swirls that are not circles that can be infinitely satisfying. And suddenly, if you can make a square and you can make a circle and you can make a triangle, you can weave any image, any shape at all that you want. And then you can start shading them by breaking off little bits of colors and mixing them up using all those marvelous tapestry techniques that we have, like hatching or hachure.
You recently released a book called Kids Weaving. How did that project come about?
My marvelous editor, Melody Fallett, called me on the phone and said, do you want to write a book called Kids Weaving? My first thought was, well, no, I'm busy. But she talked me into it, and in large part because I started thinking about the ways that weaving has affected my life and how it affects everybody's life, and we don't even know it. And I would love to be able to have that sense of warp and weft connect to kids of all ages. Initially, that was part of it, thinking about the myth and the legend and the stories of weaving that are part of our everyday thoughts, even something from the Emperor's New Clothes to the voyageurs traveling across Canada and the northern U.S. with their canoe loads of hides. They made these marvelous finger-woven sashes that they all wore, and nobody ever saw them but each other, but they held all their clothes together with finger-woven sashes. To the story of Penelope, one of the things I tried to put in here was the entire Odyssey from Penelope's point of view in a paragraph and a half.
I read that part. It was very entertaining. It's all about the gorgeousness of unweaving.
Of unweaving, exactly, which is an important factor as in any weaver's life. One of the other things I also really wanted the opportunity to do, besides that piece of it, to try to get the stories of weaving and make it possible for people to think, oh, weaving, okay, over, under, over, under. That's all it is. I can do that. Is also to get the idea of that plastic pipe loom, which is a variation of Archie Brennan's copper pipe loom, out, because it is possible then for kids or anybody, adults as well. It's sort of a subversive adult book, actually. Adults who want to learn but aren't afraid to invest or intimidated by the large equipment. It's really hard to be intimidated by a length of PVC pipe and a couple of camping straps. In an hour, you can be warped and weaving on a loom that works essentially the same way as most large looms.
I just love this book. When you open it up, it's gorgeous. The pictures are very colorful and beautiful. The kids are from all ethnicities, and they just look like they're having a wonderful time. And I love how you start from off-loom weaving. You don't need any equipment other than perhaps even a couple of pieces of paper. And then you take it through to, hey, you can even build your own loom with this very, like you said, simple and approachable loom, to doing very complicated things. I really admire this. I think it ought to be like required reading for all teachers.
Well, thank you. That would be great. I would love it. It was a wonderful project. It was fascinating to work with the kids that I worked with, Bryn and Talia initially, helping me go through all the different projects. Were just fabulous. And of course, to make it beautiful, Melanie Fallick and Chris Hartlove's photography and Lena Corwin's illustrations, all of that were essential to making it look beautiful, because that's making the particular projects was my part, but making the book look appealing and really work was theirs, and they did a fantastic job. I love that idea of people including the making of things in their lives, and I know as a kid that I just love nothing more than putting things together and making things. The pleasure I had in making all these projects was almost embarrassing, because I felt about 8 years old every time I got, oh, now I get to make a pink scarf. And now I'm going to make another weaving warrior, these little dolls. And I loved making the dolls and wearing my own hand-woven shoelaces, I have to say. It's a particular pleasure. So if nothing else, I got a lot of really great projects.
That was one of the other things that just made me so happy about this book, is there were a lot of great books about how to start weaving in the 60s. And those projects don't really appeal to this upcoming generation. But flipping through this book, I kept looking at the project going, ooh, I want to do that. Yeah. I saw your little map people, little dancing doll figures woven out of strips. I'm like, ooh, that's kind of cool. So I'm really grateful to you for building a book that's going to inspire, hopefully, the next generation of weavers with projects that, you know, flipping through, there's four or five, I'm already like, ooh, I want to do that.
Oh.
And I'm already, I want to build a PVC pipe loom.
Oh, thank you, Sai. That's just wonderful. I'm so happy to hear that.
As the mother of a small child who is doomed to at least learn how to weave, thank you for this wonderful resource. Now that you've got the book out and you're weaving tapestry again, what's next for you?
I hope I will continue weaving. And at the moment, I'm the most intrigued by where those margin notes, those long, narrow strips that brought me back to tapestry, which are very similar to a lot of the borders in my pieces. Something that you mentioned early in the interview, which was that the borders looked well thought out. And in fact, the borders were the one thing that are never thought out. I refuse to think out my borders before I start, because I love this spontaneous thing that can happen at the loom. I love just watching those shapes. So I never draw a cartoon. There's no drawing behind any of those loops and squiggles. That's just the place that I get to play every day. So if I get stuck on a face, say, or a particular difficulty with some transparent thing, I go over to the border and start building some silly squiggles. The pleasure of that is surprising to me because I always see myself as a person with kind of a relentlessly narrative imagination. I always see things in terms of stories and image, but I'm realizing more that either I have developed or I always had and didn't know I had an affinity for color next to color and color progressions and watching those colors move. My wish is that I can start making those on a larger scale. I don't imagine I'll stop making narrative tapestries or pictorial tapestries because I love that. My hope is that something's going to happen with that non-narrative direction, but I think I just have to let it happen and watch what I like and notice and wait and just keep weaving.
Thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
And now it's time for a special announcement from Weavers Against Warping. Are you a weaver who hates to warp? Well, then tapestry might just be the weave structure for you. Weavers Against Warping have compiled the top 3 reasons why weavers who hate warping should consider tapestry. Reason number 3. Tapestry warps are self-tensioning. Because they're wound in a O or C shape, you can easily get an even tension just by spanking the warps with your hand. How satisfying is that? Reason number 2, that weavers who hate warping should consider tapestry. Tapestry is slow. This means that for every hour of warping time, you can have hundreds of hours of weaving pleasure. And finally, the top number 1 reason why weavers against warping should consider tapestry. Tapestry warps can be recycled indefinitely. Do you have a design that's not working out? Colors that just don't look right together? Cut that weft off and you are left with a sparkling white warp that you can weave time and time again. You think that Penelope chick from Greek mythology was just biding her time till her Odysseus came home? Not so. She was just enjoying the pleasures of unweaving. Think about it. With the right warp, you could weave the rest of your life and never warp again. This has been a special announcement from Weavers Against Warping. And now it's time for today's audio essay, in which I describe my attempts to learn tapestry. When I first approached tapestry, I thought, this is going to be easy. It is plain weave, the simplest weave structure out there. Tapestry has been done for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. How hard could it be? Tapestry has been devilishly tricky for me. And I used to beat myself up about it, but I have learned many things in my path to understanding tapestry. And although I haven't yet mastered tapestry, I'm going to share what I've learned along the way in the hopes that if you're just trying to learn tapestry now too, I can save you a little footwork wandering down the wrong path. My first attempt to learn tapestry was on a rigid heddle loom. I took out my rigid heddle loom, I warped it up with some really strong cotton string, and began to weave. Now, the rigid heddle loom worked okay. I mean, you can get good tension on a rigid heddle. You've got your up and down shed pretty much for free. But the problem was the one I used does not have a stand. So it was really kind of awkward to shove it up against the table and then try to be fiddling around with picking up different warp threads to lay in the weft. The other problem was, as Sarah mentioned in her interview, if you're putting a wool weft on a cellulose warp, in my case, strong cotton seine twine, they're not integral. And being new to tapestry, I had an uneven beat. So my design shifted around a little bit. And that was very distressing because I would start weaving a rectangle and suddenly it would look like a rectangle by Salvador Dali. Not the effect I was going for. I did a couple of things. For Christmas, I got a brand new spankin' tapestry loom. I got one of the cute little Mirax looms. I'd been wanting one for years, and they had a little small one, and they are cute as a bug. If you've never seen one, go up to the website. I'll have a link on the show notes for Mirax looms. They're mostly copper, and they have an ingenious little shedding device. And I must say, having a cute loom is not at all necessary for tapestry weaving, but it sure improved my morale. The next thing I did was I warped it up with a wool warp. I used what is essentially a thin Navajo warp. So it's wool that was spun tightly for the purposes of weaving a rug. So you know it's strong and you know it's not going to pull apart under the rigors of having the weft packed around it. For weft, I would like to try a singles yarn like Sarah suggested, and I should just get out my spinning wheel and make some. But right now I've been playing around with some crewel weight embroidery wool that I happened to get a ton of on sale a year or so back. I've been taking two strands of this wool. It's Paternea, I think. If you buy it from the embroidery store, it'll come three-stranded, so you might have to pull it apart, but the ones I got were on the cone, so I'm putting two strands of the really thin stuff together. And that's kind of fun because you can blend colors, which is very exciting. One of the things that I love about tapestry is the ability to play with color in very rich ways. I also am excited about the design possibilities. And I think that's been one of my pitfalls, as I am so eager to rush in to do my own designs that I will try to weave a design that I don't really understand how to make in tapestry yet. And designs can be tricksy because, like, the letter C, that seems like a very simple shape to weave. But when you start analyzing it, the bottom of the C is okay. You know, you start out with a ground on the left, a ground color on the right, and the C color in the middle. But as you travel up and that C branches off, suddenly you have to have a left ground, a middle ground, and a right ground, and two separate bobbins for the legs. Either that or you're doing some interesting carrying stuff over the back. But if you don't choose solid shapes and simple solid shapes, you can quickly get yourself into trouble with tapestry weaving. I've had to discipline myself to step back and weave the simple solid shapes first. And it's hard because I want to run with tapestry, but all that's happening when I try to just take off and run with tapestry is I'm just going and landing flat on my face. The other thing to think about with tapestry is there are a lot of selvages. If you're weaving slit tapestry, every single slit is in effect another selvage in your textile, and you really have to pay attention to those extra selvages. For example, I decided that instead of weaving a complicated shape, I would weave little boxes of color like Sarah talks about in the interview to try to play with color and gain some experience with the loom and have some fun with tapestry. I thought I would weave it in slit tapestry so I wouldn't have to worry about doing joins every other row. Well, what quickly happened was between every box, a new selvage formed. I really had to make sure I was placing my weft appropriately. And so all this attention to detail, all this subtle complexity in terms of colors, the number of bobbins, and all these little selvages, means that tapestry is a very slow art form. And you just have to settle into it and decide that it's going to be slow and make peace with that. I am currently working through the sampler in the book by Kirsten Glassbrook called Tapestry Weaving. It's one of many tapestry books that I have read in my investigations about tapestry, and I'll have a list of some of those on the show notes. The reason I chose this book, to do my practice sampler out of is very simple. It had colors and designs that inspired me. I'm sure that the Harvey books are more encyclopedic, and I found some other very good books, but because part of what draws me to tapestry is color and design, it's really helping me to have a book that makes my heart sing. If you are trying to learn tapestry, I would offer the following recommendations. 1. If you can at all get yourself to a tapestry workshop, do so. If I ever get the chance to take a tapestry workshop, I will so be there. It really helps to have someone that you can ask a question of, or who can look at your work and notice things that you may not even realize you're doing wrong. 2, start simple. Don't be afraid of just weaving plain weave and then just weaving back and forth in two colors and then just weaving that simple block. It might seem like you're wasting your time, but you're not really, because what you're doing at that point is you're not weaving a tapestry. You're weaving a tapestry weaver. I would recommend using a sturdy wool warp. Make sure it was spun to be used as a warp, because it'll take a lot of abrasion. And this is not a place where you could use your knitting yarns. Knitting yarns could be weft, but for that warp, you need a really sturdily spun, strong yarn. You wouldn't want a merino wool warp. You'd want one of those Navajo, churro, wiry, super tough, coarse, strong wools. And I would pick colors to weave with that inspire you, because there's nothing worse than being frustrated and having to look at colors that don't make you happy. That's what I've gleaned from my experimentations with tapestry. If you have some great tip for learning tapestry that I haven't mentioned here, probably because I don't know about it, please drop me a line in the show notes. I'd love to hear from you. And that's all for this episode. Until next time, it's time to get warped, because everyone knows you have to be warped to weave. Most of the music I use on this show comes from the PodSafe Music Network. And how that works is I go up to the network and I search on terms relating to the show's theme. A search on tapestry, however, turned up only 3 songs, and none of them were suitable. So I went a bit further afield, searching on terms like shape and color, and I turned up this gem. I can't really justify it for the episode in terms of weaving, but it made me laugh so hard that I wanted to share it with you. If the first couple of lines put you off, just keep listening.
Was a woman, then one day she turned into a man. Then she went funny, then she became a woman again. Then she turned into a fish, I don't really understand. Shapeshifting lady. Sometimes she's treacle, sometimes she's the closet in the hall. Sometimes she's tea towel stacked inside the closet in the hall. Sometimes she is small mice, I don't understand it all. Shapeshifting lady. Chameleonic freak. Is that her up on the shelf? Or she wins at hide and seek. She can't hide behind herself. All I really wanna say is that I love her for her. But when she like her is she today? She could be a stone or an ambulance or a microscope or the south of France. She could be your dad, she could be your mum. She could be a sheet of titanium, a brandy snap or a gravel rash, or a bank robber with a pile of cash. She could be the moon or a wooden fort. She could be a moment of abstract thought, raspberries or some pinking shears. She could be Fyodor Dostoevsky's ears, a piece of cheese or a waterfall. She could be a priest or a juggling ball, a glass of milk or a candy bar, or an office block. It could all be her. She could be a can or a hemorrhoid. She could be a volume of Sigmund Freud.
I mean, a rock song that contains references to both tea towels and pinking shears. How could you not like that? Weavecast is brought to you through the generosity of our donating listeners. This episode, I'd like to thank Anna and Gina. Our sponsor this episode is Just Our Yarn, purveyors of gorgeous hand-dyed yarns and weaving kits. You can check them out on the web at www.justouryarn.com. Additional funding for Weavecast comes from the Hand Weavers Guild of America and the Seattle Weavers Guild. Thank you all for helping make the show possible. Our musical guest this episode, Man Bites God, with Shapeshifter. These artists generously shared their talents on the PodSafe Music Network.